All right, welcome everybody to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 180. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and joining me today, special guests, John Lindemann.
Hey, hey, hey.
Greg Lay.
The hoy hoy, everyone.
And James Jones.
Are we really special guests?
Yeah, man, it seems like forever since you... No, you're not special at all. Just roll with it, man. All right, we do actually have something very, very special to tell you this week. I figured I'd start off the show this way, just to get us all amped up, but we got an email from the PAX East people a couple of days ago, and found out that our submission to do a live version of this very podcast at PAX East has been accepted. So, we're going to be there on March 26th, that's Friday, March 26th, in the afternoon at the Wyvern Theater at PAX East, that's the Penny Arcade Expo. We are going to once again blatantly copy One Up Yours and do a live podcast thing in front of an audience, which will hopefully include you listening right now and a lot of other people at PAX who've probably never even heard of us before. I'm really, really excited and scared about how it's going to work and what it's going to be like.
I remember years ago listening to the episode before the One Up Yours guys did the first one at PAX. And they were talking about being terrified that no one would show up, so...
That is a legitimate
By
concern.
Extension, that is legitimately terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Like if you walk in and nobody's there, yeah. that would be horrifying.
Well, I did. I started a forum thread in the podcast area of the forums about this. It's kind of a planning and a meetup thread, so... If you are a regular listener and you expect to be at PAX East, or you now expect to be at PAX East, just for us,
just to get us, just to take us out.
Yeah, I actually do know a couple people who are waiting to hear on this. They're people we know, like Carl and Mike Sklens, but they're gonna be there.
I'm sure somebody from Chunsoft is gonna come there and assault James.
Oh, I hope so. Yes. Chunsoft known for their American presence. But PAX East, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's my first PAX. I'm really excited. I've wanted to go before, and I just never could really justify the cost to go out there. And now, out of sheer vanity, I have to. So it's going to be...
Just make sure you get your hair did, Johnny.
For sure. And my nails did, too. But it's going to be...
French tips.
Quite an experience, I think, to do this podcast live. Not only, I mean, you have to realize, it's for us, it's doubly weird, because not only are we not used to, like, looking at each other while we do this, but we're also definitely not used to having an audience. So I was chatting with Carl today, and I joked that maybe we'll put a laptop up on the desk in front of us just for the visual.
Just look at that. Just eyes on your instruments, boys.
Right.
Don't look at the crowd.
Going into the eye of the storm.
We have Skype connections to each other's computers. That are 3 feet away from each other.
So we haven't really settled on who all is going to be on the show. It depends a little bit on, you know, whether we can all make it. I definitely intend to have some special guests. I can pretty much guarantee Carl is going to be there in some form. I hope I can drag Obi up there a little bit too. Billy Berghammer is kind of a maybe right now. It depends on whether he shows up at the show. But I'm really excited. I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know what we're going to talk about. One thing I definitely do intend to have is a live Q&A. You know, we do listener mail every week on this podcast, and I would love to do that live. So, again, if you are a regular listener and you plan to be there, save your A game on the questions and bring it. And definitely introduce yourself to us. You know, either before or after the panel, or we might even kind of try to plan some kind of social meetup at a local bar or something like that. We'll go have some Boston Lager and, you know, hang out a little bit. I think that would be awesome to hang out with some listeners and some fans of the website. So, you know, I don't have any details on this right now, but it's happening in some form, and I'm pretty thrilled about it. I really am. I've been thinking about it for 2 days nonstop. I feel like we made it, you know? I feel like we're there.
Oh, premature.
No,
that's right. It could all go terribly wrong.
It could be the nail in the coffin.
Even if it does, we showed up.
Yeah, well, I feel almost to a certain degree.
We're not the only one.
Also premature.
I feel to a certain degree, sometimes I feel like we kind of toil in obscurity.
Oh boy!
Yeah, actually, doing it out in public is gonna be pretty cool.
I like that we're just keep pushing that bar up, just keep sliding.
We're definitely gonna. I can't guarantee what the audio is gonna be like, but we are going to make every effort to record the panel to be podcast as an episode, like a special episode of the show. And so from my view, even if nobody shows up in the live audience, at least we still get a 1 hour podcast out of it, mm-hmm. you know?
Dare I suggest we find a way to stream it?
Okay.
Let's make this as hard as possible. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, I think Carl has offered to help a little bit with some of that stuff, and I've been talking with Skip Pfister on some of the technical details of how to deal with this audio and what we can expect when we get there. So I'm taking this really seriously. I want to make it awesome, and I'm going to do my best to make it awesome. So, yeah, that's the big news. We're all a flutter.
Yeah.
And like I said, if you're planning to be there, hit up the forums on Nintendo World Report and go and find that thread about the PAX East live panel, and you know, let us know that you're coming and let us know what you want it to be, and you know, you can chat with everybody else who's also planning to be there, and we'll make some arrangements. We'll get together and do something fun.
I would just like to thank in advance that one person that shows up and realizes 20 minutes in that they've actually come to the wrong panel and leaves. I would like to thank them. I'd like to go ahead and thank them.
Hey, guy.
Hey, yep. What is this? A podcast, great podcast, guys. I gotta go.
Miss the merits of Mega Man's 437 panel.
That's right. He gives us a big thumbs up on his way out the door as
well.
We're still
you know, if that panel's going on at the same time as ours, I'm going to be there. You do realize that, right?
That's actually my main concern is that we're going to get scheduled up against some kind of behemoth attraction that everybody, including us, will want to be at. Mm-hmm. And so they're not going to come to ours, even if they might have been marginally interested in what we're planning to talk about. But so anyway, that's the big news. We will be at PAX East. We'll be there in March. March 26th, that's Friday. And moving on, we have a thing we do every week on this show. It's called Biz Nouveau, and John Lindemann is going to kick it off.
Biz Nouveau.
All right. My new business this week, I downloaded, as some of you may know, I have a Nintendo DSi, which allows me access to the voluminous library of DSiWare.
Yeah, he
programs.
Uses it sometimes.
Every once in a while, I look at
paperweight.
It on my floor. Yeah, Dark Void Zero, Capcom. It's supposedly a kind of retro. It's interesting the way Capcom did this. It's like an 8-bit NES game. They just released Dark Void on 360 and PS3, and this is their kind of backstory for it is that this is a long lost original version of that game. Something to that
it's
effect.
It's kind of like retro. It's kind of like a piece of retro game challenge, isn't it? It's like a fake retro game.
Yeah, fake retro.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very like they've presented it in a very tongue-in-cheek manner.
Like more than anything else that has ever been announced for DSiWare, hearing about this kind of made me want to get a DSi. So I've been very eager to hear your thoughts on it, John. Is it actually good?
Yeah, it's good. It's very much like a Bionic Commando kind of flavor. The control scheme is a little bit different, but it's very much like a side-scrolling platformer. The main difference between this and something like Bionic Commando is that you fly around with a jetpack. So even though you can run around and shoot things and, you know, hop from platform to platform, you can also use your jetpack in two different ways. You can tap A twice and you can hover. And that lets you pretty much move around the screen slowly. So they kind of set some stuff up like you have these obstacle course type areas where, you know, you can't touch the sides of an electrified fence. And, you know, so you have to kind of move around in space, move up, down, left, right, all over the maps. The maps are almost like kind of like Metroid-ish.
I love when you talk dirty to me.
Horizontal, you know.
Oh.
I know what you like, Johnny. You sick bastard.
Oh.
And also the other way that you can use your hover pack, you can just kind of go straight up. You can almost launch yourself and then come right back down. And so there's different ways that they kind of, you know, employ that. They set up the things that you have to collect for score. For you, it's a high score game. Like you can set high scores in it. So it's kind of arcadey in that respect. So you can collect like these little orange orbs for points and stuff like that. And the way that they set those up, some of them require you to just shoot straight up through them. And the top screen is your map. And the way that you progress through the different maps is you have to go to certain areas, collect a key card, come back. You can get different guns. You can get a gun that shoots, you know, rockets. And so certain doors require certain guns to open. And so that's pretty much how you progress through the game. There's other sort of sub-elements. You can pick up journals. And I think that there was something on his show the other night about this.
Whose show?
That's what I'm getting to. The first journal that you collect refers to Captain Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that, I don't know, somebody, they name-dropped him.
Is it supposed to be some, like, the part of the intricate faux backstory is the idea that in the past they were planning to hold a contest where people would, like, submit some sort of suggestion and the reward was their name would be put in the game. Ergo, a child Jimmy Fallon was a fan of something and ended up getting his name in the game.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it's a pretty obvious name drop. And I know I was watching, I have the, on Twitter, I subscribe to the Capcom blog, and they had something in there about some reveal, you know, being made on Jimmy Fallon's show the other night. So that was probably it. Yeah, so, I mean, it's in terms of, you know, graphics and music and everything, it is 8-bit Capcom. I mean, the music is complete chiptune that, you know, like, doop, 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 like that kind of stuff.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
It's all the way along.
I hope they put this on, they need to put this on WiiWare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting point, though, isn't it? You've got a WiiWare, you know, it's been going a lot longer than DSi, where it isn't a fragmented user base issue like with DS Lite, DSi, and you've had the proving ground of Mega Man 9 for this particular kind of product.
Right. Yeah, but on a much more broad...
Yeah, it's a bigger IP, but the point is that you've still got at least some idea that there's a market there for it on WiiWare, so why would you put it on DSiWare instead of WiiWare? I mean, could anyone think of a good reason? Because when it's a authentically retro game, it's not really going to use the two screens or touch screens in a meaningful way.
It would certainly be cheaper to develop it for the DSi.
It seems almost like they almost made it as kind of almost a promo tool for the 360 and PS3
game.
Yeah,
I know, I totally get that, but it's a promo tool that I want really badly.
Yeah.
The point is, you know, there's people like Johnny that have a Wii, that haven't got DSi yet, and that's going to cut off some of the sales to them. I think it's a peculiar choice when you've already broken this ground on WiiWare.
Maybe they just feel like that since the goal of this product is to promote the game on the 360 and PS3, it'd be kind of odd to use the Wii as the promotion tool.
Then again,
using the DSi is not that much less odd.
Yeah, I mean, let's extend the question yet further. I mean, the point is Mega Man 9 and 10, they're multi-platform on the download services. So wouldn't it make sense to make it WiiWare and PSN and Xbox Live? Because, you know, then...
Right.
You've got the Nintendo fans that are old school Capcom fans can get it on WiiWare, but then the people that, you know, might buy Dark Void, the HD game, you've got that complementarity on the other systems as well. Why would you cut yourself off from all of this to go on DSi? I don't get it. I really don't.
Well, you know, it launched on DSiWare, but it could certainly come to other things. I mean, Capcom just brought Phoenix Wright to WiiWare.
Oh, I agree with that, but we're back to the promotional tool argument. The timing is everything. I mean, you would think it's very dependent on while the Dark Void name is out there and prominent in the gaming media because there's a big HD game coming out, although it's not getting that well received. But, you know, if you release it on the other stuff later, people might just kind of forget about it because the name's not topical.
Well, yeah. It's... I don't know. Maybe they just decided that they wanted to make a really low resolution game because on the DSi it would be a much lower resolution game than it would be even on the Wii. And they wanted to make it dirt cheap. And they felt like, well, you know, any money we make on this is practically profit. So let's just throw it out there.
I mean, it's only $5.
And maybe Nintendo gave them a sweetheart deal on it just to get something on the DSi that's actually...
Well, that I almost...
That's
plausible. In one sense, I'd kind of be skeptical because Nintendo, of all the platform holders, seem to be least in the business of sweetheart deals. But at the same time, like, why the hell else would they do it?
Yeah. I mean, it has to happen. I feel like the DSi needed something, and this is something. And
it
Nintendo is apparently not going to develop that something themselves.
Been waiting for that extra processing power to be put to use.
That's right.
They finally have.
The thing is, too, I think that kind of tying it in with another game, it's probably actually easier to sell than just throwing out a random 8-bit game, especially when it's brand new.
You're piggybacking onto the mindshare. You know, it's got traction. It's easier, you know, for the media outlets in the gaming industry to tie it in themselves when they write stories and stuff like that and associate the content. It makes it easier to find for people to get the word out. I mean, so that part of it makes plenty of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope and Capcom is known for porting their games to everything, so...
Yeah.
I'm really hoping this gets ported to other things, because at this point, as they release more and more things for DSiWare, it does become somewhat more tempting, but at the same time, as we get closer and closer to the inevitable successor to DSi, which may or may not play DSiWare games, it becomes a little bit harder for me to justify buying a DSi because I don't want to get caught in the transition period between systems, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I really don't know why Nintendo isn't making games like these for DSiWare.
Because they don't want to devote resources to it.
Well, I suppose more accurately, commission games like these. Yeah. You don't have to make them.
Yeah, know, exactly.
Really,
Well, even then, they're still devoting resources. I think they literally just don't care.
They are devoting some resources, but you know, that you would think relatively that ability to just, you know, lend out their IP, commission something, and provide some degree of oversight is less precious than their actual development bandwidth.
Well, what's interesting too is that this game, even though it's published by Capcom, I think it was actually created by a team called Other Ocean, I think.
They made a bunch of iPod games and the CSI Deadly Intent DS game.
Okay. Well, maybe they made it for DSiWare because they have some experience.
Yeah.
That kind of portable, yeah. I mean, it's cool to have it portable. Don't get me wrong. I like playing old school games on portable. Like Retro Game Challenge being a good example.
Yeah, but it's pretty cool, though. If you like Bionic Commando, you should check it out. I think it's pretty short. I believe it's only 3 levels, which I believe is 3 maps, but...
But it's $5.
Yeah, I mean, it's $5.
Yeah.
So,
man, it's really tempting. Dark Forge Zero... I am jealous. So I'll go next with new business, and I've got a bunch of stuff here for Xbox 360. I'm sorry, I haven't been playing much Wii in the past week.
All of a sudden, Johnny's turned into me.
No, it's just a cycle thing. Next week, I think it'll be a lot different. My classic controller Pro is coming soon. My
Sweet.
Imported controller, and
I'm jealous.
Do we have anything to use it for though, besides just holding it?
Well, I mean, I have like 80 WiiWare and Virtual Console games, so a lot of those are compatible with classic controller. And I have things like Geometry Wars Galaxies, which I am more than happy to go back to and play some with my new controller just to test it out.
That's what I did.
Yep. And, you know, there are things coming out soon like Tatsunoko versus Capcom, which I'm not sure if I'm going to buy it. I'll at least rent it because I definitely enjoyed what I played of it at E3 last year.
Yeah, just for the chaos. It's worth it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fun.
I'm quite tempted to actually purchase that because... It does feel a lot like Smash Brothers, which obviously I'm a big fan of, and they added online play. So as long as the online works, it's a wait for reviews kind of
thing. It's a wait and see proposition there.
Yeah, because the online could go very, very bad. But if the online does work well, then I'm probably pretty comfortable with buying a copy of that for myself. I'll probably feel like I'll get my money's worth out of it. And the Classic will help a lot with that, because I'm not going to go buy a $100 joystick for my Wii. Like, what the hell else am I going to use that on, you know?
You might not.
I would.
You should.
Yeah, because you bought a stick for Street Fighter 4.
Dude, I actually have 2 PS3 sticks, and I have a 360 stick. That's a good question, James, and frankly, I have no answer.
Well, then you pretty much are obligated because of your position to buy a Wii control stick just because.
Don't forget, he bought the PS3 version of Street Fighter 4 just to duck James, apparently.
That's right.
That's how I remember it, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, anyway, in terms of Xbox stuff, I played through the campaign of Modern Warfare 2. I haven't touched multiplayer. I'm tempted to. I'm definitely excited. That's part of the reason I bought it, but... The multiplayer in Modern Warfare 2 is going to eat me alive once I start it. And because I got so many new games at the same time, I thought, well, I know the campaign's short because John told me. So I'm going to play the campaign and then I can move on to another game and then I'll come back later for multi.
That's exactly what I did.
That's what I'm doing. And,
yep.
And, you know, I was looking forward to the campaign. I really enjoyed the campaign in Call of Duty 4. Modern Warfare 1, and I really like the campaign in the sequel too. It is definitely crazy as hell. Like the stuff that goes down is wacky shit. Like it's pretty much like it gets into like Red Dawn territory of like plausibility and everything. And the really interesting thing about the way these two games from Infinity Ward, the way they tell a story, is that they don't spoon feed the story to you at all. There's a lot of subtext, there's a lot of, like, passing references to key elements of the story, and if you miss it, you're not really going to understand what's going on, because the way that they present it to you is, it's very immersive. I mean, the idea is that you are this, basically, no-name soldier in the army, and when you go into the mission, you're being told what to do from one moment to the next. Run here, shoot over there, blow up that building. But in terms of why you're there or what the fuck's going on in the big picture, you don't really know. And in that way, I think they're trying to communicate things the way that, like, a real soldier would get, in that you may be able to follow some of the political stuff in your off time, but the way the story is told is that this all happens in the matter of, like, 4 or 5 days. So it's going down so fast, nobody, maybe even your commanders, don't really know what's going on. They're doing what they've been told, and now you're doing what they tell you. And so the mission structure is, you know, it's always very obvious what you need to do from one moment to the next, but it's never obvious why you're doing any of that stuff. And the reasons for all of that are in the game, but they're just, you just have to really pay attention and try to piece a lot of things together. It's a very interesting way of telling a story. And they, you know, Infinity Ward, they did this in the first game, and they do it even more in the second, but they really like playing with the fact that you're in these characters' perspective. That you're playing in a first-person perspective, and they like to put you in situations and do things to your character that you're not used to seeing from a first-person perspective.
Like dying,
yeah, which happened in the first one.
Yeah, but in like a slow and gruesome way where you're like, wow, I've never seen that before.
Sometimes, yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, they're definitely, I think, really pushing the forefront of how you can use first-person perspective to tell interesting stories and to make maybe familiar situations feel completely different and very new because of that perspective, because you're actually playing it, because it feels like it's happening to you. And they're very, very good at doing that. I think the problem is that they're telling such a complex story that happens all over the world that they want you to be able to kind of be in two or three places at once. And so they keep transplanting you between or among several different characters, several different people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times in a given mission, I'd have, like, my commander would be saying, Ramirez, get over there. And I'm like, is he talking to me? Oh, yeah. Okay. He must be talking to me. Because you play as, you know, three or four different characters with different names and you never talk. You can very easily lose track of who you're supposed to be. But again, it sort of makes sense in that you are this kind of chump soldier. And, you know, who you are as an individual is not really that important. Like, you don't necessarily need to have a personality. What's important is your role in this combat mission, mm-hmm. you know, or if, you know, you blow open a door and kill a terrorist. Like, that's what makes you important, not what your name is or, you know, what your favorite food is. So it's interesting, but because they do jump back and forth and put you in different characters and they kind of, you know, they have these multiple parallel storylines going on, it can get confusing sometimes as to where you are and who you're supposed to be at that time. But overall, it's a pretty impressive experience. And I know John was telling me it's really short, but my completion time is almost 8 hours. So maybe I'm just really, really slow at playing this kind of game. But...
Well, were you going for like the computers that you can pick up?
No, I never found a single one. I thought they'd actually taken that out of the game from the previous one until I beat it. And then I looked at the achievement list and it's like find 40 something. There's an achievement for finding like 40 something secret files. And I was like, I seriously thought they had taken that out.
So did I. You know? So did I. I thought
so
because
they must be really well hidden.
I mean, they were pretty well hidden before. I only found a handful of them.
Yeah, but I did come across a couple accidentally. And I think maybe it's that in the second game, they do an even better job of making it very clear where you need to go. And so it's less likely that you'll stumble across a place that you're not really supposed to be. So you'd actually have to go and actively explore and look for something.
Yeah, and I mean, and some of the areas, I mean, you're just trying to not get your head blown off, and you're just running
through.
That's
how it feels a lot of the time.
Yeah, like it's pretty chaotic.
So, I mean, I know this is an Xbox game, but hey, just think, in 2 years it'll be on Wii, so
that's right.
Eventually this will be relevant to our audience. A game that I don't think will ever be on Wii, and that is truly a shame, is Batman Arkham Asylum. It is, wow. For some reason, I trusted all the opinions I heard about it, that it was so great. But I found it difficult to get excited. Maybe it's because it's licensed, or maybe because, you know, Commissioner Gordon looks like a linebacker or all this weird stuff that I'd heard about it. But it was sitting in front of my TV for a week while I played through Modern Warfare 2. And I finally just put in Batman and said, okay, well, let's go with it. And it starts off a bit slow, but like after 1 hour, I was absolutely hooked. And just the great thing about Batman is that it continues to surprise me as it goes through. Like, you know, maybe it does get repetitive eventually, but I'm pretty far into the game and I still don't really know what's coming up. And it's a very, very exciting feeling. I think the comparisons to Metroid in this case for Batman feel a little bit overblown. I think there's some superficial stuff in terms of the way the map looks and the fact that, you know, it is possible to backtrack to an area and get to places that you couldn't before. But at least up to the point where I'm at, you don't really need to do that. It feels, you know, pretty linear in terms of what you need to do next. Whereas I feel like Metroid and Metroid Prime are a lot bolder in giving you an ability and just turning you loose and letting you figure out what to do next. They, you know, and yeah. Even in Metroid Prime, they'll send you in the right direction, but even then, it's pretty vague as to what you need to do and how you need to get there.
It tends to be a pretty guided experience, Batman, doesn't it? You know, you've got various things that
it
leads
is.
You from one place to the next, like the evidence trails in the detective mode.
And it makes sense because of the story and the characters that are involved here. There's a lot of talking. There's a lot of text. And, you know, you've got someone in your ear literally helping you figure out what's going on, as well as villains who are kind of egging you on and trying to lure you into their traps. So it makes sense that it's more guided because you're interacting with all these people. Whereas, you know, in Metroid, Samus is just on her own and she's got to just fend for herself. She's got to figure things out on her own, which means the player does too. So again, I think on a deep level, Batman is not as Metroid-like as I was expecting, but that's okay because it's still totally amazing. I mean, a really brilliantly put together game on every level. And, I'm just kind of shocked at how great it is. So, yeah, I'm really addicted to that right now. I've been playing it pretty heavily over the past couple days. I think it's fantastic. I really do. So, really quickly, I did rent, Red Faction Guerrilla, another Xbox game. It's actually, I had some Wii games at the top of my Gamefly queue and I guess they're a little bit harder to come by right now, so they sent me Red Faction, which was pretty far down the list. And it just came at the worst possible time, because it came on the same day that I got my UPS package with Call of Duty, Batman, and Assassin's Creed 2. It's like, Red Faction is totally a fun game, it's a good game. I want to go back and play it at some time, but it's not going to compete with all that stuff. It's just not. So I played it for a couple of hours and said, okay, this is pretty good, and I stuck it back in the mail. But it's kind of an open world game. You set on Mars. It's actually really fun. You tear down a lot of buildings in a very satisfying way. And the story is kind of interesting. I think the main problem is that it's on Mars, which sounds cooler than it looks. And it ends up being that every location is really red and brown, and there's just not a whole lot of variety in terms of what you see. You know, there's a lot of places to explore, but I think one of the things about, you know, I'm a big fan of exploration in video games, but there's an art side to that too. There's a presentation side to that in that, you know, I'm not going to be driven by mechanics alone, by purely some kind of game reward in terms of finding a treasure or, you know, accomplishing some kind of mission that I've been given to explore. I need to see something new that makes me feel like this world has special places. That's a huge part of exploration and Metroid Prime is excellent at that. The whole series. You know, even if you find some little nook or cranny, some secret room that probably 80% of the people who play that game will never see, it has some kind of special thing about it that makes it look or sound interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that bugged me from, like, way back when I played Gears of War 2. There were, like, little nooks and crannies all over that game, but nothing to find.
Right. Red Faction feels a bit like that, in that it's a huge world, it's open, very open, you can kind of grab a vehicle and go anywhere, but I'm not sure why you would want to. It's more fun to just do the missions, because the missions are fun. One last thing before I wrap up new business here. I did want to mention I was watching Nintendo Week again this week because I can't.
The guilty pleasure, apparently.
I can't quit you. And, you know, they were talking, they had this really horrific episode set in, you know, it was like Greco-Roman shit. And it's celebrating the release of Glory of Heracles. And, you know, seeing the game, I kind of got interested in the game and I thought, I'd like to try that. So I go to, you know, I back out of the video, and on the Nintendo channel, I go down to the DS demos place, and there's no demo of Glory of Heracles, which came out this week. I mean, Nintendo hasn't added a demo to that in, I can't tell you how long. I mean, I know they didn't put one up for Mario and Luigi. I know they didn't put one up for Zelda Spirit Tracks. And now they don't have one for their brand new IP in America, Glory of Heracles.
Mm-hmm. Demo.
This is really a game that people would probably like to try before they buy. They've never heard of it before. It's an RPG set in ancient Rome. I mean, or ancient Greece, excuse me. I don't understand why there's not a demo. I mean, I can get a demo for Avatar the Game DS, you know, but I can't get one for Glory of Heracles, which is Nintendo's own game.
I mean, I can't really speak about the European situation because I haven't checked that for quite a while, funnily enough, but it's equally woeful for the most part on the Japanese service. And, you know, again, there seems to be an inclination towards licensed titles, including Avatar the Game,
in Japan.
Well, it's universal, man. You know how much they enjoy the works of Jim Cameron from Titanic going down so well there. But you know, it's the same sort of stuff, and you get games like the new Chibi Robo doesn't get a demo, Spirit Tracks, stuff like Mario and Sonic will get a demo, and so these licensed anime games or whatever. It's the same trend, and I find it in some ways even more baffling on the Japanese side.
Maybe they charge for demo listings. That's the only thing I could think of.
Were they going to charge themselves?
No, but there's a limited number. Maybe they feel like there's a limited number of slots, and they
it's like an opportunity cost issue.
I could charge this publisher ¥1,000,000 to list their crappy anime inspired game.
Yeah, that's why they still have Brain Age. They still have Brain Age 2.
I don't know.
in America, I mean, Nintendo has never taken down a demo that they put on there. Now, apparently they're going to take down WiiWare demos at some point for who knows why, but they'd never take down DS demos, ever.
I don't know. I mean, I have
the list just gets longer and longer, but it's filling up with shit. Why don't they put something good on there? Seriously, I'm going on a trip this weekend. I would like to have a DS game. I was thinking about buying Glory of Heracles. If I could try it, I might actually go buy it. But since I can't, I'm not going to drop $30 on that game, especially not when it's getting sevens, you know? That's a very borderline kind of thing for me. Like, I may or may not like it. So I'd like to try myself, and I can't.
It raises the question about how the titles get chosen for demos, yeah? Because if you was going to suppose that the people that you use the demo service the most are people that are relatively tech-savvy and relatively kind of well-informed, are they hankering to play demos of licensed DS games, really? Or would they prefer to play, you know, some of Nintendo's sort of, you know, B lineup, or like a Glory of Heracles, or like a Chibi Robo in Japan? You know, it seems to me, if you was going to suggest that it would be better to more vigorously promote their own titles. So, you know, but therefore, do they think that people who just, like, you know, saw the movie Avatar are going to then look on their Nintendo channel and get it down? It's either way, it doesn't seem to hang together all that well.
It's a mess.
So I question whether there's a strategic direction behind it at all. Maybe it's more like James. Yeah. Maybe it's more like James says, and it's kind of a marketplace, and it's just whatever comes out.
I really stand on my statement that I would not be surprised if they charge for listings on that service and a significant amount of money.
I don't know. I'd be surprised. Cause games with, you know, what I would consider to be probably very little marketing behind them, they do end up on there. Stuff like, you know, Cooking Mama 3 or whatever. And that, I don't really know what Majesco has to gain by putting that on Nintendo.
Well, you know, you could catch the lax Cooking Mama fans.
Well, as I mentioned when I actually played it on the Japanese service, Soul Bubbles, which was a sort of, you know, notable commercial flop, even though it got pretty good reviews, being localized in Japan months later, that gets on there. But you know, some of these other stuff doesn't.
But there was never an English demo of that, because I wanted to play that game. I wanted to try it.
Really?
I would have totally tracked down a copy of that if I could have tried the demo and, you know, and if I liked the demo, but they never put a demo of it up. So I never bought it. That's how it works. All right. Well, I've talked way long enough. Greg, please follow up.
Yeah. So I played through the vast majority of Dead Space Extraction at this point. I haven't quite finished it yet. I mean, it's longer than your average light gun type game, like Overkill, I guess, but it's still not that long.
I believe it's a guided first person experience.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up.
Lovely marketing speak.
It's, well, it is significantly different from your typical kind of light gun game in a number of ways, I suppose. I mean, the first thing is just, it clearly would never work in an arcade because it's just so damn talky for a start. You know, there is so much dialogue and there's just so many parts of the game even though they don't have dialogue, that are kind of more about the cinematics of it, you know, trying to build tension and...
Is it too talky?
That's
what James felt about the demo.
Well, I said the demo was a bad choice.
That was what was interesting to me, because I recalled that discussion on the E3 episodes many months ago now, but the question was, you know, was that a bad choice? Did they choose a bad part of the game to show because it was too leveraged on dialogue in that particular part? But the thing is, it actually seems to be quite difficult to get a big part of the game where there isn't much dialogue. I mean, that's kind of the flow of the game. That's the pacing. It's broken up either with, you know, some pretty extensive dialogue stuff or with these kind of tension building parts where you're slowly maneuvering through an enclosed space and, you know, you see a few things in the corner or you're trying to keep the glow light stick thing sort of, fully illuminated so you can see what's going on. So the pacing is kind of, you know, sort of this slow kind of rhythm punctuated by sudden bursts of kind of violence, and they do some things of kind of alter perception things, like, you know, the sort of visual, you know, obviously it's first person, so they're doing all this stuff of like as if you're being kind of driven mad by the crazy force that's at work or whatever the hell is going on in Dead Space. You know, so you get these like little sort of bits of kind of cryptology sort of coming across your view, and you know, see if things that aren't there, and you know, maybe you see a monster and you go to shoot at it and then all of a sudden it actually was a person, and there's all this kind of stuff that, you know, definitely you would never get in an arcade like gun game.
Right.
So while I don't necessarily buy the whole PR routine about guided first person experience, this, that, and the other, it is substantively different from House of the Dead and all that kind of stuff. And not just in tone, which obviously it is, because it's trying to be genuinely scary. It's not horror themed, it is horror, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which it kind of succeeds. You know, it's difficult to be that scary, but the world of Dead Space, at least I feel, has a good tone to it and sort of makes a good earnest effort at it. You know, I don't find it kind of laughable, which I frequently do with horror films and games generally.
So those
parts of it I'm all right with. The visuals are definitely very impressive in general. I think the lighting in particular is very important for lending the atmosphere to the game in some of the locations, so that's very good. Also the facial animations for the dialogue scenes, which, you know, is very important because of the amount they make up of the experience, those are good. You know, the lip syncing, the expressiveness, that's there. The voice acting is kind of patchy. Some of it's pretty good and then some of it's not so good. It's a little erratic, and it seems to be a mostly European cast, which I don't know is associated with the fact it was developed by Eurocom, who I think long ago made the World Is Not Enough game for N64.
Yeah, they go way back. They've made all kinds of stuff.
That's a bit of random trivia there, but yeah, lots of British accents, and which is kind of a bit, doesn't quite jive that well with I mean, they're different characters than Dead Space, but you know, or some of them are. There is some overlap. I mean, there's a lot of nice callbacks to the original Dead Space if you've played that. In particular, I like the fact that you begin the game, obviously it's a prequel, but you begin the game geographically pretty much where the original Dead Space ends, which is nice. And it's recreated, you know, fairly faithfully, even though obviously it can't convey the kind of full grandeur of it that you would have had on one of the HD consoles. And then you kind of get taken almost on a tour through the locations of Dead Space, kind of backwards, essentially, as you go from the mining colony to the ship and then through the ship. You know, it's pretty much the opposite order that you went through with Isaac in the first one. So that's neat, seeing everything. And obviously you're seeing events that were alluded to in the original Dead Space. All that. So it's not like heavyweight stuff, but it's just like if you played the original Dead Space and you liked it, it's neat to see all this stuff kind of unfolding. And it helps because you've got a lot of good art direction and design and concepts just done for you already. You know, that must have helped a lot with making the game, because you've got all these cool locations just pre-made. And then extends to the gameplay insofar as some of these wrinkles that you can put into a light gun kind of action game using the concepts from Dead Space. So you've got the kinesis stuff, where you know you can pick up objects and throw, you know, say for instance they're throwing projectiles at you, you could snag them out of the air and throw them back at them. Obviously you've got the stasis, which could prove very useful, like buying time to reload, things like that. All the different weapons and the secondary functions, which you access by turning it on its side. You know, all these kinds of things make the gameplay more kind of varied and more interesting than I would imagine a lot of straight up light gun games would be. However, I think there is something of a failure to capitalize on that fully, because certainly with the range of weapons you've got and the abilities you have, you could have had some really, really interesting bosses, but the first one is 2/3 way through the game. I mean, you know, it's just, it could have had, you know, stuff that, you know, that's kind of like a, you know, got a puzzle element to it, and it's, you know, varied and different and spectacular and all this stuff, but they pretty much just passed, and most of it is just this, you know, cinematic kind of theme park ride, to some extent, punctuated with bits of dialogue, and that I think is a real missed opportunity. I mean, perhaps the very, very end of the game, which I've yet to play, is going to capitalize on that a bit more. But it, the first third of the game in particular is begging for something, to do more in that area.
I feel like I just played that same game then.
The Crystal Bears.
Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps so.
The reports are that Extraction sold incredibly poorly. In 2000.
Oh, yeah. Like 9,000 copies or something like that?
In the first few weeks, yeah.
I'm really curious if EA will make any kind of valiant effort to reintroduce it to the market, either on Wii or, you know, maybe a kind of quick and dirty port to another system. PSP seems like it might work.
What about when they get the motion controller working for the PS3,
well,
maybe?
Well, see, that's kind of a more expensive endeavor to upport it to a more powerful system, because
I think if it was downloadable though, you could probably get away with not doing like a massive overhaul. And it looks pretty good. I mean,
I'm sure it does.
It wouldn't hold up that well, but it does look. I think they did a really good job with the visuals in general. Yeah. I mean, the frame rate's a bit skittish at times, but you could fix that on a more powerful machine,
right? And you know, it maybe if they do end up porting it to a different system, you know, they could potentially go in and fix some of the pacing, maybe reduce some of the cutscenes a little bit, or add in an extra boss.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because, you know, I appreciate what they're doing in many ways, and I like Dead Space. I'm not, you know, totally uninvested in it, so I could get something out of it. But at the same time, as the game, it does end up being a little bit too passive for me. Yeah. You know, they try and keep you sort of attentive rather than checking out totally of these scenes where there's nothing to shoot, because there's always like, okay, there's lockers in the background. So if you kind of click them with your reticule, you'll be able to get ammo and supplies and stuff. And so what tends to happen sometimes is while the conversation's going on, you're too busy sort of trying to snag that bit of ammo in the corner to actually hear what's going on.
It's weird, because, like, you think of, you know, one of the major criticisms of these light gun rail shooter kind of games is that they're already too passive. You're not playing it enough at any given moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird that Dead Space Extraction would kind of, you know, very upfront they acknowledged people's, you know, apprehensions about putting it in this genre. And they kind of indicated they were going to take a lot of steps to, like, really make it something different. And one of the key things they did was to make it even more passive by having people talk at you for half the game. Like, to me, a very strange choice. And I wonder if it ended up kind of not working out the way they expected it to.
And perhaps not. I mean, but some of the other things they put in there, there's parts where you're sort of soldering connections and stuff, like little mini games essentially with the pointer. But the part where that actually is good is if you do it in co-op, because what can happen if you play it in co-op, like, you'll have monsters running towards you while your character is supposed to be soldering this connection, but it makes you trade off between the two of you. So, like, you'll have to solder one connection, and then your friend will have to do another, and that means you have to also trade off for who's shooting the enemies and keeping them at bay while all this is happening. So that sort of breeds a little bit of sort of fun kind of pressure on each other or whatever, you know, that kind of works in co-op. Doesn't really work so well just on your own. But I mean, I guess these sorts of games are often best played in co-op. Yeah. Although co-op games also don't lend themselves to you sitting in silence and listening attentively to the dialogue.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, James, what you got, man?
Not much, actually. So I finished off Spirit Tracks, which, just to give my quick summation of that game is that it's kind of easy. I'm going to go ahead and say that it's mostly because we discussed last time I was used to the previous game and it was so close to it.
And that wasn't very hard, was it?
I thought it was easy too, James, but I actually got so frustrated on the final boss that I just gave up and never beat it.
On which one? This one?
When you're on top of the train and you've got Link and Zelda, the controls were bothering me so much there. I was so frustrated with trying to make Zelda do the right thing. That I played it like 3 or 4 times. It was just like, fuck this. I don't care enough.
I thought that was the easiest part of the boss battle. That shit that comes
out. It's more annoying than it is difficult.
It's just annoying trying to kill the mice, and I couldn't.
What comes after it is this stupid thing where you have stuff heaved at you and you have to hit it.
Yeah.
And it goes on forever.
It does go on for a long time.
And you miss one, you start over. It's so irritating.
I was surprised by that. I definitely think the best way that it upped the challenge at all was some of the puzzles were a little more clever. But
a little bit,
it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I really only felt challenged in the very, very, very last dungeon. And there's a whole section that's in the dark. And that was kind of a pain.
I actually kind of like the room in the dark. The last dungeon, again, it just kind of annoyed me after a while trying to switch Zelda through all these different suits with the different powers. It was a good usage of the mechanics they'd already set up, and it was interesting combining these different abilities for Zelda, and putting them together in ways they hadn't been put together before. But the process of transferring her from one statue to the next, and the way that they arrange these phantoms so that sometimes you have to go across 2 or 3 different floors to get to the one that you need next, it's just too much. It's just really just bad.
Late in the dungeon, it's okay because you have access to that one room that they're all in.
But, right, yeah. But before that, it's so laborious. It's a good idea. It's not implemented the way I would.
See, I thought that was kind of funny because what they had been doing the whole time was they had been introducing these new phantoms with new powers to you, and it didn't really click to me they were doing that. Like, it was just something. It's like, oh, this one has a torch. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I didn't really realize they were introducing them for later puzzle solving. So when they threw them all together and forced you to pick the right one for your current need, that's kind of a neat way of building on what's already out there.
For sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. It feels like they could have done more with it. At the same time, I'm still happy with it. Mm-hmm. The only time I ever really got upset with it was that stupid boss battle at the end with the deadly tennis times 30.
Yeah.
So, playing anything else, James?
Well, I did start Dawn of the New World which I bought back in like December 15th. I just started it and I'm in the middle of a tutorial and I'm falling asleep on it. So
yeah, I think 2IP called it like a 4-hour tutorial, I think.
Yeah, it's supposed to be pretty horrifying, but if it's like the other game, it's like 48-hour game. So in the grand scheme, it doesn't seem like that much percentage-wise.
Right.
But overall, it's massive.
It'll be like a 3-day game for James.
I'll start it tomorrow evening, and I'll finish it up Saturday evening. We'll be good.
Well, it's time for a break. When we come back, we'll have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. This week on the website, we have a review of Jumpstart: Escape from Adventure Island, written by Pedro Hernandez. It's a children's game, but Pedro answers the question of whether it's really educational or just kind of cutesy and bad. And Pedro, we should say, he is a licensed teacher.
Mm-hmm. On this week's newscaster, the crew talks about Silent Hill Shattered Memories, Netflix on Wii, the return of NBA Jam, and the NPDs for December.
The notorious NPDs, not to be confused with Notorious B.I.G.
Shut the hell up, John.
I'm just keeping it straight.
Yeah. And also, Neil has impressions on the podcast and on the website of Hudson Soft's Calling for Wii, telling us whether or not he was scared by the infamous Black Page.
I don't know what that means.
You'll have to read it and find out, Johnny.
Andy's got a review of Silent Hill Shatters Memories, which he apparently likes a lot. And Pedro reviews Kamen Rider Dragon Knight, which is a fighter.
For the Wii this time.
For the Wii, yes.
DS last week.
I was about to say, didn't we already talk about this?
You can never get enough Kamen Rider.
Apparently Kamen Rider is kind of related to Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, or it's similar. And I don't know if I should admit this, but it makes me more interested in that game than I would have been otherwise.
All right, and we have an interview this week. We talked to Dan Muir and Legendo, who is a company making a WiiWare game entitled Pearl Harbor Red Sun Rising, which is an aerial combat game.
That is a really cool interview.
And also we have impressions. Lauren Lewandowski gives us her thoughts on Rooms, the main building. It's another Hudson Soft Wii title. It's a puzzle game set in a mansion in which notorious. Mr. Book is apparently the antagonist there, trying to trick the player.
And he is what his name says he is.
Yeah, he is literally a book.
He is a book.
What he is trying to do
is trying to turn you into the next Mr. Book.
Sounds like The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's what's happening on Nintendo World Report this week. Check it out. Let us know what you think. Welcome back to Radio Free Nintendo, and following up something that we started last week, we have four new entries in our Game of the Decade feature. Once again, we're not really debating them here on the show right now, we're just kind of playing them for you as we get them in, and once we get through the full set of nominees from members across the entire Nintendo World Report staff, you will decide who comes out on top. But I do want to make note, just to address some of the concerns that people had in the forums. This is not about a deathmatch among our favorite games or something like that. The goal of this feature is not to put down any one game. For my part, I'm going to try to avoid that at all costs. So this is about praising and lifting up games that we love. So with that said, the first game this week is Wii Sports, and we're going to hear from Pedro Hernandez.
The game that I chose as one of the best of the decade is Wii Sports. It's funny how a game as simple as Wii Sports could be considered as one of the most defining of the last decade, but the title accomplished so many things in just a few short years that it deserves to be there with the likes of Pac-Man and Super Mario Bros. As one of the most influential ever. When the Wii was still just an abstract concept, filled with potential, Wii Sports was the first game to show what the new motion-based system could do. It took the universal appeal of sports and combined it with the ingenuity of the Wii Remote in order to create a game everyone from experienced gamers to senior citizens could understand right away. Wii Sports was also the first game to fully utilize the Miis, avatars that were simple in design but brimming with personality. The motion controls were very easy to learn and they were nearly perfect in execution. Pick up the Wii Remote, swing it like a bat, like a golf club, bowling ball, or a tennis racket. It perfectly captured the Wii's ideas of gameplay that would be simple to understand, but one that yields death or rewards upon its completion. It was the game that made people buy a Wii. Without it, the Wii wouldn't be the phenomenon it is today. Such was Wii Sports' impact that it transcended the gaming culture and reached pop culture in a manner most positive. It helped change the negative stereotype that video games were bad for you. To this day, no other Wii game, save for Wii Fit, has been able to replicate its success. 3 years after its release, people are still buying a Wii for it, people are still playing it, and people are still having the time of their lives with it. And because of its significant contributions to both the gaming industry and popular culture, Wii Sports is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the best games of the last decade.
Alright, the next one is Andy Gergen for Majora's Mask.
When I initially played The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask back in the year 2000, I recall being blown away by how the game sort of took shape, the way it created a living, breathing world that pulses around you and has its own agenda, you know, separate from your own. The game taught you new gaming skills like time management and showed you real emotion in the Cafe and Andrew subplot, which was a part of the game that was, you know, completely optional, but I think more than anything kind of shows off what the game was really all about. I came back to the game in the winter of 2009, and I really didn't expect to have the same reaction. but I honestly could not have been more wrong. The game does hold up as one of the finest games Nintendo has ever produced, and a shining example of what the Zelda franchise is capable of, given, you know, the right creative freedoms. Coming off of the critical and commercial success that was the Ocarina of Time, the Zelda team was only given a year to make another game, and with that kind of pressure, it's pretty amazing they could put together a game that's really this successful creatively. Of course, that's just my opinion, and it's not shared by everyone. Nintendo Power ranked this game, I think, 11th out of the 13 Zelda games in a recent issue, beating only Four Swords, which really isn't even a mainline game in the series, and Zelda 2, which has probably more detractors than fans. The save system certainly presents you with some unique challenges and can make you feel rushed, which is probably the antithesis of the Zelda experience. And, you know, on my initial playthrough, I did feel rushed at times, but by the time you reach the midpoint of the game, you've learned how to work the system to your advantage. So I guess the final question is this: what makes The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask one of the best games of the decade? Well, quite simply, there's nothing else like it. It has the wide-open exploration and dungeons of a Zelda game, it has the living, breathing world of a GTA game, and a sinister, dark plotline unlike anything else I've ever seen developed by Nintendo. Quite simply, it's one of a kind.
Hell of a case made there. And next up, we have Grant Buell talking about Metroid Prime.
This is Grant Buell, and my game of the decade is Metroid Prime. I'm pretty late to video gaming compared to most people at Nintendo World Report, and though I had played a few N64 games, the first console I bought and really got into was the GameCube, and one of the first games I bought was Metroid Prime, and I was totally amazed by it. The detailed graphics and complex world design immersed me more than any game I've played since Ocarina of Time. And it convinced me to go back and track down all the classic Metroid games I had never played before. Once I played them, I was really able to appreciate the translation that Retro Studios pulled off with Metroid Prime. I had been expecting a GoldenEye-style first-person shooter with it when I sat down, and instead it gave me a sprawling world to explore, amazing power-ups that gave me access to more and more of that world, and complex boss fights that almost felt like puzzles themselves. Metroid Prime is probably the game that I've gone back and rebeaten the most number of times in my life. And I think it's Nintendo's crowning achievement of the last 10 years.
Wow. All right. And fourth and final for this week is our own John Lindemann.
Hi, everybody. This is John Lindemann, director of Nintendo World Report. And the game that I've chosen to represent for Game of the Decade from 2000 to 2009 is Wii Fit. And the reason why I chose this title is because I think that it embodies the kind of overarching theme or overarching principle that Nintendo acted upon over the course of the decade with both the Nintendo DS and the Wii console, and that is expanding the audience of video gaming. The Blue Ocean philosophy of roping people into the video gaming hobby with titles that don't necessarily follow the typical video gaming archetypes. And I think Wii Fit is the primary example of this, where you take a concept of that a lot of people are interested in, whether they're video gamers, non-gamers, old, young, and that is staying fit, and packaging this into a product that lets you do it in an entertaining way. Also, you can't deny how much it's sold. I mean, I think Wii Fit has sold, I think, 22 million at this point. Wii Fit Plus, which is a spin-off title, really doesn't really have a whole lot of new content, but even that has sold, I think, 8 million copies up to this point, which is amazing since the MSRP of Wii Fit, I believe it started off at $90, and it also packs in a peripheral. So you have, you know, not only the price, but also the fact that people may not even be able to use the balance board peripheral for anything else. So it's just amazing that the Wii Fit franchise has sold, you know, almost 30 million copies at this point. Also, it spawned an entirely new genre. Other fitness franchises have been started in its wake, and they've even been successful, such as EA Sports Active. So, once again, I mean, you have a huge new IP for Nintendo, pretty much created out of thin air, and so that's why I think it's Game of the Decade.
Well, Wii Sports and Wii Fit being in here, I think, kind of throw off the whole formula, because they're not what we might have even considered to be, you know, typical video games 10 years ago, and yet now it's hard to imagine video games without those two. They may not be your favorite games, or they may not be the games that you play the most often, but I mean, if you're going to look mainly at influence, I think it's it's pretty easy to see how both of those got nominated. And then, I mean, Metroid Prime, I don't even know what else to say about that. We talk about that game so much, but Majora's Mask is, I'd never heard of that Nintendo Power ranking thing that Andy mentioned, but that's shocking that they would put it 11 out of 13 on the best Zelda games.
Yeah, really.
I really can't imagine who the hell is writing for Nintendo Power these days, but yeah, I mean, it's probably my favorite Zelda game. And even if it's not your favorite, I think it's hard to argue with the things that Majora's Mask achieves and the things that it tries and actually succeeds in doing. Of course, I wouldn't put Zelda 2 at the bottom of that list either.
No, I'm not sure I agree with the has more detractors than it has fans. It has more people who haven't played it and assume it's bad than
there's some of that. But yeah, Majora's Mask is a crazy experience, and I think it's something that hasn't really been imitated since it came out, and certainly not in the context of a big, grand action-adventure game in the Zelda vein. I mean, that they would go and incorporate the stuff that really probably evokes Animal Crossing more than anything, and that they would be able to streamline that with what we expect from a Zelda game and actually pull it off on both ends is crazy to me. It's just unbelievable that they managed to do that and that it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting case where they really didn't start as they meant to go on with Zelda, and that opened the decade. There were several games after it, but none of them were sort of radical in their aims.
Right. We thought Wind Waker would be really radical, but it ended up being, I think, probably more conventional than we expected.
Yep.
Wind Waker.
Just in a different wrapper.
It looks very radical, but in the way it plays and the way it's structured and put together.
Well, I mean, it introduced some new combat elements. Besides that, it's basically, I mean, it's exploration. It's kind of interesting because there's no world map when you start out.
Right.
So it literally is exploration versus...
Well, I think Wind Waker may come up in a later week, so we...
Better. For the whole stack.
There is room for more than one Zelda game on this list, let's put it that way.
Assuredly. And then, I mean, with Metroid Prime, it was interesting to hear Grant come at it from the different perspective in terms of, for most of us, it's, you know, the joy of seeing Super Metroid essentially channeled into this 3D game with a bit of Ocarina of Time in there, and what a wonderful sort of synthesis that was. But Grant was coming at it from the fact that he actually discovered the other Metroid games through Metroid Prime. So I think that's kind of testament to another part of its power, that it could make you do that if you hadn't played the previous Metroid game. So I think that does kind of burnish its credentials a bit beyond those of us that just had such fond memories of Super Metroid that we wanted to kind of relive in a different way.
Also the fact that with Prime being one of the first games that he would be playing, wow. What a way to start off a hobby.
It's really quite a complex game, not just in terms of controlling it and the mechanics of playing it, but in the design and what that game expects of you. It's really an advanced game. I mean, I remember it was surprising to me that Metroid Prime sold as well as it did, given how closely it does adhere to the traditional Metroid formula, which I think of as being kind of a niche thing, you know, like I think it takes a special kind of obsession and appreciation for subtlety to really get into a Metroid game that apparently there were millions more people who could do that than I thought existed. And I was really surprised when Nintendo made Metroid Prime one of the games you could get for free when you bought a GameCube, you know, back in, was it 2003, when they did that deal for a while. And apparently a lot of people picked up Metroid Prime from that deal and discovered it and really fell in love with it. And I would hear from people who I didn't even really think of as gamers talking about Metroid Prime because they got it through that free game deal, and I thought, wow, I mean, I'm so glad that Nintendo put that game into people's hands who never would have tried it otherwise, because it really, I think it opened up a lot of people's eyes to what could be done in a game design and how a world can be put together.
Yeah, I mean, I guess stuff like Wii Sports pretty much the polar opposite of Metroid Prime.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we're really going to get into when we have to cut down to the shortlist, or when we have to argue that out amongst ourselves. But yeah. I think, I mean, it's a very compelling case to be made. Obviously, it's a sort of very different kind of case, but it is nonetheless very compelling when you think of how many people, you know, it's got in the hands of. And as Pedro said about you're kicking off the Wii phenomenon, I mean, John made a good case for Wii Fit, and I'm sure there's plenty of people that approach the Wii from the perspective of getting it for Wii Fit. But I think there isn't Wii Fit without Wii Sports to some extent. Right. That first inroad that gets made with what they did with, you know, redefining the perceptions and really, you know, it's a packaged game with a console. You know, it's kind of in many ways defining the console itself, the brand, because it was completely new and weird with that game. That is so influential in so many ways, and it is a compelling case. And also, I mean, it is fun as well for the most part.
Sure, Wii Sports is a wonderful game. I think for me, the argument against Wii Sports is that we now have the sequel Wii Sports Resort, which trumps it in so many ways, and not just iteratively, but really. For me,
experience-wise,
yeah. For me, Resort is really what I wanted out of the original Wii Sports.
But you're not picking that game for its merits.
Well, I mean, James, you're obviously focusing on influence here, but I mean, for me, it's a combination of a lot of factors, and one of those is the quality of the game experience. And for me, Wii Sports, and maybe it's just that I got burned out on it really early because I had I had one of the first Wiis in America, and so I had this train of people coming over wanting to play Wii Sports, and all I wanted to do was play Zelda and Excite Truck. I was sick of bowling within days of when I got my Wii, and that's nothing. It's all I heard about for months after that was, you know, oh, bowling. I don't give a fuck about bowling. So I was so over that, and it really soured that game. And the sad thing is, I do like Wii Sports.
Sure. I mean, if Wii Fit wise, I mean, that's one of these things where it's more of an achievement in some ways, because just the fact that it, you know, it just came from the idea of tracking your stats and the hardware design and all that kind of stuff. It's that you went from that quirky little initial concept in Miyamoto's head to this juggernaut. I mean, it seems, you know, quite logical that a fitness game could, you know, catch on that broadly, but from where they started with just like, okay, how are we going to make an interactive weighing scales into a game, basically?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, he kind of started out as it really being more about weighing yourself than exercise.
Yeah, he just liked plotting graphs of his own weight.
It was more of an app.
He's basically an accountant. I mean,
likes
graphs.
It's interesting because Wii Fit kind of started as what we now know as the Wii Fit channel, where you go in there and you weigh yourself and it tracks it, and that's all it does. And from there, they realize, well, we can't sell this $80-$90 peripheral with a tiny little application with it. We have to make something that goes on a disc that feels like an, you know. But to me, the really fascinating thing about the Wii Fit case, and John did a good job of highlighting this, is that much more so than Wii Sports, it's really not even a game. I mean, it is an application. It's something that you use to get a tangible result from. Whereas Wii Sports, for as revolutionary as it is in many ways, and Pedro, you know, explained it very well, but Wii Sports is a video game, and moreover, it's a sports game. I mean, this is in some ways, it's very familiar.
And as long as they've been video games, that's one of the first things they were doing. Is
to me,
is emulating
Wii Fit
sports.
Is far more radical a departure from what we've come to expect from video games.
It does include, to be fair, some of the balance games and things which got embellished in Wii Fit Plus. So as you said, they did feel the need to beef up the package to try and make it worthwhile overall, which clearly the market has decided that they did do a good enough job of that. but the core of it is that stat tracking. The core of it is the idea that people, you know, in many ways, it's not about so much the exercise you do on the board, but it's about kind of formalizing you thinking about your weight and your fitness in an explicit way.
Right.
Yeah, and making that kind of accessible and fun.
I have a hard time with calling Wii Fit a productivity application or whatever. I mean, it is a game. The premise is you play these games with the intention of becoming fit.
The genius of Wii Fit is the simplest way to put it is it makes exercising fun. But I think on a more profound level, it gets you to do things that you probably wouldn't be motivated to do otherwise. By adding in this kind of, it may not be the most entertaining thing in your library of discs that you could put in your Wii, but it's entertaining enough to keep you going when you might not, if the only output was some kind of physical benefit. So yeah, I mean, you're right, James. It is, I mean, it probably doesn't get enough credit for the gamey elements of it that it does have. All right, well, now we're going to get to your listener mail, and John is reading the first letter.
All right, Russ Greeno from the UK writes, "It's now been over a year since Nintendo unveiled their SD card-based storage solution for the Wii. This gave us up to 32 gigabytes of flash storage for all of our WiiWare and Virtual Console software. I am now quickly reaching the capacity of my 2 gigabyte SD card, and as such will likely invest in a 32 gigabyte card sometime soon. What I wanted to know is how, after a year's worth of SD-based storage solution, you gentlemen are finding the situation. Are you still happy with SD cards instead of a USB hard disk, or do you think Nintendo dropped the ball?"
I think they did exactly the right thing.
I think they did too.
They should have done it a lot earlier. But the way that they did it is exactly the right way to do it.
No, I mean, that was what was so confounding about the whole thing, is just that they didn't do it earlier. But, I mean, I've got a pretty ample collection of Virtual Console WiiWare games, but they're spread over two systems because of the PAL and the Japanese. Mm-hmm. So I actually haven't had to stretch it too much with the certainly not stretching a high-capacity SD card. But, yeah, I mean, I don't really feel like that puts a particular restriction on what you're able to do with it. So I'm not hankering for a USB hard drive or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it also really works from the kind of the Nintendo standpoint of just having something that you don't really have to worry about. It's probably not going to break. Very simple to use.
Simplicity.
No moving parts.
That's right. Yeah, well, I mean, true. If you think about it, the Wii's only got a handful of moving parts, but like my netbook has no moving parts. You know, it's got a solid state hard drive, and I'm not worried about it breaking at all.
It's nice. It's like a DS.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to break because there's nothing in there to break, essentially. Yeah.
If the subtext of the question is, has the SD card channel changed the way that you think about buying games or the way that you play games on the Wii? For me, it most definitely has. I have things now on my SD card that I can pull up very quickly, and they may be WiiWare or Virtual Console games that I don't play often, but I like to go to every now and then, and that I have them at my fingertips in this way. It ensures that I will actually go play them sometimes, whereas if I had to delete them and re-download them, I probably wouldn't go through the trouble.
Mm-hmm,
and also, it removes any sense of hesitation about buying new games, because I know I can download it straight to the card, and it's just that easy. And the thing is, before the SD card solution, I was downloading stuff every week because it was part of my job. You know, I was writing recommendations for Virtual Console games, I was writing reviews for WiiWare games, and sometimes I would even get points or gifted games from developers to review. So, like, this was a task for me, was to download stuff, and it drove me crazy because the system was so bad. And the amazing thing is, I download almost as many games now, even though I still have to pay for them. I now have to pay for them myself, but I still download a lot of games for Virtual Console and WiiWare, because the system works now, because it's no longer frustrating, and I'm just, it's very freeing to not have to give a shit about all that stuff.
It's perplexing that, especially knowing, that Nintendo has this, very reliable sort of diehard fan base, so enthusiastic, that the old system was set up in such a way that essentially sort of dissuaded high volume use of the downloadable content venues.
Exactly.
I mean, it's bizarre that it took them so long to remedy it, in my opinion.
I mean, I don't even move anything around anymore because I just download everything directly to the SD card.
Yep, you could just forget about it. Exactly.
Could not be simpler.
I mean, in reality, I probably download the least of the group here, just because I'm much more inclined to enjoy having physical copies of things. And I don't buy a whole lot of Virtual Console stuff because I still have all my old stuff hooked up. But, I had a 2 gigabyte SD card sitting around because I had a 4-pack, and that one was left over, and I'm never going to need another one. But I'm not sure you need to buy a 32 gigabyte SD card.
I think that's a bit extreme. Unless you're like a really heavy Rock Band user or Guitar Hero user, and you download a lot of songs on your Wii, then you might want more than 2 gigs. But if you're primarily getting WiiWare and Virtual Console stuff, I think 2 gigs is probably enough for most people.
I don't know there will ever be 32 gigs worth of stuff to download.
No, because of the file size limits.
Yeah. You know, I think the interesting thing also about the storage solution is, and of course we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of when that thing was released, but the interesting thing is how it's even changing development for WiiWare. Because, I mean, if you read our developer diary on the site about Gravitronics, those guys, when they first started developing that game, were making a lot of effort to keep the file size as low as possible because it was before the storage solution. And people were very concerned about filling up their fridge. And they wanted to make the game very small so people wouldn't have to worry about that. And in the middle of their development cycle, Nintendo says, oh, you know what? It's not really a big deal anymore, you know. And it ended up kind of affecting, and it ended up kind of changing their development cycle, maybe not in a good way because of where they had started. But I think for games that start now, it's a benefit, because even though the WiiWare file limit is only 40 megabytes, at least you know you can max that out and nobody will
without worrying about people sort of being dissuaded from it. But I mean, I guess that's the one thing about this situation. What we haven't seen in the past year is any movement towards raising that cap in any way, because the storage solution makes it more workable.
And they really should.
Maybe see some more ambitious WiiWare games, which would be nice, but we haven't had any movement on that, unfortunately.
I wonder if it's going to end up being one of the major third-party publishers who pushes it, because the legend on, you know, Xbox Live Arcade used to have a 50 megabyte limit. Not that much different from WiiWare. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty ridiculous, because these systems were shipping with 20 gig hard drives. Most of them were shipping with 20 gig hard drives.
Unless you're an idiot.
Well, even now they sell systems without hard drives, but they have some built-in memory now, which they didn't have back then.
Yes.
But supposedly the story is that the way that limit eventually got raised, and then eventually raised again and again, until at this point there is no limit, effectively. You've got 3.5 gig games for download. But the way it got raised was you had developers like Konami coming out and saying, well, we want to put Symphony of the Night on Xbox Live Arcade, it's bigger than 50 megabytes, and fuck you. And I mean, basically, the third party has enough clout, and the game they release is going to make so much money for Microsoft on their download fees that Microsoft really cannot make a good argument for keeping that limit, because there's no way that game gets compressed smaller than 50 megabytes. And so they said, well, we'll make an exception just for you. And within a month, that limit had been dramatically increased for everybody, because it's just release the floodgates. And I wonder if that's feasible with Nintendo. I mean, maybe Nintendo as a corporation is much less movable than Microsoft.
They are massively stubborn. I mean, they are easily the most stubborn company.
Yeah, and they also aren't as hinged to kind of downloadable content as Microsoft and Sony are either.
Well, this is yet another reason why I wish Nintendo's internal teams were developing for WiiWare. Unfortunately, they're still
they
not.
Because
they...
Games.
Yeah, if Miyamoto wanted to make a WiiWare game, and it came in at over 40 megabytes, he would move that limit. And that's an extreme case, but I mean, even a smaller team at Nintendo, I mean, if they're making a WiiWare game, Nintendo sees it has a lot of potential sales, but there's no way it's getting below 40 megabytes, Nintendo's gonna increase that limit, because there's really no reason not to. It's so arbitrary. But unfortunately, because WiiWare is primarily used by very, very small companies who are just really thankful that for the opportunity to even be in the marketplace, I don't think anybody's really in the position right now of pushing Nintendo and pushing back on that limit. I kind of feel like we probably won't see the 40 megabyte limit changed until the next system.
And then if you want to make a big downloadable game, you can make it for the other systems. I mean, unless there's a particular reason why you think it would sell better on a Nintendo system, you have other choices. Whereas, you know, back in those days with Microsoft, that was the digital distribution game in town. And so there wasn't really an alternative for Konami other than to lobby Microsoft to lift the restriction.
Yeah. All right, well, I have the next letter. It's from Slade, and not really a question here, but just a very nice email. Slade writes, I've been listening for 2 to 3 months now. All I'm doing is sending a thanks for giving me good insight to video games. I don't get to discuss this subject with anyone I know, not a soul. So it is very refreshing to listen to others, passionate and much more than I, talking about one of my favorite subjects. Thanks again for sticking to this. I am positive that it is hard work, and I would hope I could contribute more than this in the future. Thanks again.
Thanks, Slade.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's very nice. And Greg has the next letter.
Okay, this is Oswald from New York, and he writes, I recently finished Flower. It took me a total of 2 hours. And Silent Hill Shattered Memories. That was short, but I've never connected to a game in such an emotional level before. Besides Super Metroid, I never really felt immersed in a game before. Do you guys think that games have reached the level of art? What are some games that have immersed you in its world? And most importantly, why games like the ones I mentioned before seem not to sell? As I write this, there is a rumour that the new Silent Hill Wii game sold less than 50,000 copies. Why are games that try something artistic or different always frowned upon?
I think the makers of Dead Space Extraction wish their game had sold 50,000 copies.
Yeah, really.
Well, perhaps so.
Depending on the budget, that could be a hit. For Silent Hill, I don't think it was, but in that game's defense, it is coming out on PS2 and PSP as well, so they're not done yet. And I think also Silent Hill has such good word of mouth that it has the potential to have some legs to it, as many Wii games do.
Mm, that's true, but it's definitely a soft landing for that IP, isn't it, relatively? Yeah, not that Silent Hill's been on a great roll, you know, for a while,
right.
I mean, because
the
Homecoming game didn't do that great on HD consoles, and you know, I don't think the Room did that great, so it's not on a hot streak.
Well, I'm definitely excited to play it. I just found out over the break that I'm going to have it in a few days, so I'm after everything I've heard, I'm not a Silent Hill fan, I'm not really a survival horror game, but I'm not really a fan of that genre. But after everything I've heard, it sounds like a crazy experience, and I'm really looking forward to trying it out. Yeah, do we think that games have reached the level of art?
I don't know. See, I've always looked at games. I mean, the games as art thing. I mean, I look at games almost like you could look at a car, like some really really nice car. It's like there are technical aspects to it, but then there's an art to the design of that car, right? Now, you don't have a story aspect or anything like that.
But the car itself is not art. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess games have that added element of having kind of a story to them, right? So,
well, they can do. I mean, they certainly don't have to.
Exactly.
Either. I mean, that's what's so rare about them is that it really is... Yeah, the different games kind of express themselves in different art forms, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, so some are so leveraged on the visual parts. You know, I mean, there's always going to be, because they are visual, there's always going to be a sort of intrinsically artistic element there in just about every game, even if it's sort of incidental to some extent. But then in terms of, you know, narrative ambitions or how they use the music or how they try to emote using the gameplay, perhaps in some cases.
I think,
you know, because gameplay at times is simply, you know, a game from the point of view of something that could be won or lost, or something where your performance could be assessed.
Yeah, just an activity.
But then in other cases, the gameplay is meant to evoke something from you, which I think is probably a more unique kind of art form that within games, that something, an interactive form of entertainment that gets you to do things that provoke an emotional response from you. That's a different kind of art than what you've got in the other media, whereas the visual stuff and all that is kind of like your bits of other media kind of amalgamated.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's the reason why the question is even being asked, is because it takes all of these other forms of art and that people are usually can easily put in their little boxes and say, okay, well, this is art because it's a painting. This is art because it's this. This is art because it's that. And it matches them all.
Games are so freeform.
Yeah.
To me, that's exactly why games are art. I mean, for one thing, I don't really believe that art is a level that you can reach for, you know? So I disagree a bit with the premise of the question, but
it kind of implies qualitative things.
Right, right. I think there are bad games and bad art. But I think games in general are an art form. And, you know, if I had to justify that, I would say even if you take the simplest game that essentially has no graphics, no sound, no story, that game can still be art. And it can still be criticized. It can be, you know, looked at in a critical, artistic way. And to justify that, I would say, let's look at more broadly at gaming beyond video gaming. I mean, about the Library of Congress. And Greg, you may not be quite as familiar with this, but the Library of Congress and the Dewey Decimal System classify sports as fine arts. Going back hundreds and even thousands of years, you know, things like the original Greek Olympic Games were considered basically a form of art. I mean, all of us here would probably agree that football kind of has an art to it, or can be looked at in an artistic way. And there's no graphical element to football, really. It's how the game flows and how it's put together, how it's designed, and how it's executed by the people who play it. And when you bring that back to video games, to me, and just like I said last week, I mean, the things that really attract me to video games are the design of them and the mechanics and the way that they play out and the way that they're put together in that way functionally. And I think, you know, in the same way, they can be artistic for all those same reasons, even before you even consider all the things like the presentation and the, you know, the other elements like that, the narrative that may be in there. So I think games are so much art that they confuse people. And
I would agree.
And some very well-meaning people like Roger Ebert can't even grasp just how artistic games are because, like John said, that you can't really fit them into a box. They're artistic on so many different levels and on so many different faces that it's hard for people to even grasp.
Now, I think some people may want games to achieve the level of high art in one area, or they might consider a game art if it was as written as well as the best stories throughout history, kind of thing. You know,
if you isolate these different aspects of gaming, you find very, very few, maybe no examples of, even in the very best video games, of where the story stacks up to even an above average story in a movie or a book or something like that, or a play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same for the music. You find very few video games where the music could stack up to Dark Side of the Moon. But, I mean, to me, where the best case is, again, in the interactive elements and in the functional design parts of it. But also, I think if you are able to kind of combine all these different aspects of gaming and look at it as a whole package, I think, you know, some of the best games stack up extraordinarily well against some of the best examples from all these different other kinds of art.
And also, because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it can't happen.
I mean, a pretty good example would be something like horror games versus horror films, I think, because, I don't know, maybe it's just because I've been thoroughly desensitized from a young age, but it's very, very difficult for me to find anything remotely involving or scary about a horror film. But because the game is interactive, you know, I just think inherently you feel more tension because it's, you know, it's leveraged on you in a way. And, you know, it's not because necessarily, you know, the sights and sounds that they've crafted are necessarily so much more terrifying than what's in a game, what would be in a film. But the fact that you're involved draws that emotional response out for you. Therefore, it's, you know, it's a more, in terms of what that particular kind of art form is trying to evoke from you, I think that interactive element makes it more effective. So, I mean, that's one case where I think you see it be more effective. But I think some of the problem is that the games being so derivative of other media is why it's often not seen particularly favorably when it goes to conversations about art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because so many games are just, you know, just relatively shamelessly kind of pilfering from films or whatever. People seem to think that those elements are just kind of borrowed and incidental and not creative.
Right. I think the frontier of gaming where it's really pushing itself is in the games that are moving away from imitating other forms of art and are kind of exploring the elements that are unique to gaming.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a number of those things. I mean, obviously, the sort of burgeoning morality stuff in games, you know, but the making decisions and taking paths and how that affects things. You know, again, inherently going to be a kind of emotional response kind of thing because it's, you know, asking something of your character or, you know, what you want to see happen.
Well, I think games have kind of had an interesting swing because it's almost like the industry, when they were kind of given this graphical horsepower to work with, and I'm talking like maybe say from like the early 80s all the way through to now, you kind of saw the industry like in the early 80s to mid 80s, you saw games that, you know, because they didn't have a lot of graphics to work with, there were almost more things like the morality kind of stuff or taking kind of a mundane task like Oregon Trail, taking a mundane task like that and wrapping a game around it. And, you know, it's like a classic game, but when you play it now, you're like, wow, this is more like school than it is like a game. But back then... You know,
that's why they let us play it in school.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing because they didn't have the graphics. You did actually see more of that. But as graphics became better and better, that kind of shaped the direction of the industry. And now that the graphics have sort of maxed out, I think you're kind of seeing, like, with games like Mass Effect, you're seeing kind of there's other places to go other than graphics now.
Well, and I think it's not just that the graphics have been maxed out. It's also that, you know, and this is in large part thanks to Nintendo, but because the audience is so much bigger now, I think a lot of developers are considering ideas in terms of the kinds of games that they're willing to make or the ways in which they want to advance their craft that they wouldn't have thought of otherwise, because it's no longer about a race to the most realistic graphics.
You can't wow people anymore.
And it was for a few years for a lot of developers. That was the key driving force. That was the main feature of my new game, is that it has better graphics than the one I made last time. And now that gaming, the audience has expanded so much, you really need to think bigger than that. You know, you really need to think a little more out of the box and figure out, why are you making this game? And why would someone want to play it? Because it's probably not just for the graphics.
But, I mean, what about the idea about this? This is about the commercial success of games that are leveraged on drawing an emotional response, perhaps more than, you know, the more traditional aspects of gaming, like achievement and, you know, or, you know, sort of social aspects or whatever. What's the best-selling game that you would say is effective in that area, for instance?
BioShock did extremely well. Primarily based on the story. You know, that was the word of mouth. That's people weren't going crazy about the plasmid system in that game.
And it didn't have multiplayer.
Yeah, it didn't even have multiplayer.
I would say probably there has to be some games on the PC that really...
Half-Life a little bit.
Yeah, Half-Life, definitely.
Half-Life kind of works on that level.
It's certainly true that a lot of the games that are the most commercially successful are, you know, more sort of pure games, you know, competitive multiplayer games like first-person shooters, sports simulations, driving simulations, especially in Europe, you know, they are pretty dominant. But I suppose, you know, also you have to say the open world games, the Grand Theft Autos of the world, have kind of come in. And that's interesting because obviously they have narratives and they have characters and all that kind of stuff. And they're, you know, pretty damn derivative of films like Scarface and whatnot. Absolutely no question about that.
Godfather.
But also, I guess there's the kind of more basic level of it in terms of the emotional kind of response of it being of the sandbox and just doing, you know, whatever the hell you like. That's probably the where I would look at it being sort of more artistic than just its ability to ape films from
the 80s.
How
many people play Grand Theft Auto for the story?
I have no idea.
Almost none. So I feel like we're maybe missing some obvious selections here. We're kind of on the spot. But I think if you set out to make, you know, for instance, something like Indigo Prophecy, even the upcoming Heavy Rain, which is very artsy on the face of it. I mean, almost pretentious in that, you know, the developers of that game are setting out to make something that is so weird and orthogonal to what you're used to in gaming that there's a very, very high risk of that game just being a commercial failure outright.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably will be. And I don't even know if it'll be a good game. I don't know if I'm going to enjoy it, but, you know, I think it's a risk that they're willing to take, and bless them for putting it out there and at least trying something. And you know, if it does take off, if it gets crazy word of mouth like some of these other games we've talked about, then who knows? It could be the next phenomenon. You know, people could say, oh my gosh, have you played Heavy Rain? What happened at this part? What did you do at this part? Well, I did it this other way. It certainly there's that potential as well, but I think it's a huge risk. I think most of the really, really successful games that we have, you know, I think a lot of the games that have been successful in the past 5 years, for instance, they do include elements of this. They do consider themselves artistic entities. I'm kind of humanizing the games here, but they strive for a certain level of artistic expression while also appealing to the masses, as they have every right to do. And so I think you have a lot of games now that sell millions of copies that have emotional and very interesting and progressive narrative elements, but that's not the only reason, maybe not even the primary reason that people are buying it. You know, maybe people are buying Fallout 3 for the awesome graphics, and they're surprised by the deeply effective story that is told through that game. So I'm fine with that. I'm fine with the Trojan horse method of developers kind of sneaking these radical game designs and very bold artistic choices into games that really have a lot of mainstream appeal. I think that happens really more than you realize. So if you're going to look at the really obvious, super bizarre, you know, really exotic, artistic, you know, intentionally artistic games, yeah, maybe a lot of them do kind of fail. But I think a lot of games are quite effective at incorporating many aspects of those into something that a lot of people can still enjoy.
Something like Final Fantasy VII, I think, isn't that one with the death of Aerys?
Yeah, that's
Final Fantasy VII. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of always up there on the list of saddest moments in video games or most emotional.
Well, is that because the directing of the scene is so powerful, or is it because you played the game for X amount of hours to get to that point?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the point, though. I mean, that's where the gaming part of it is different. You know, how it affects you on an emotional level is different because of what you invested in it, not just with, you know, your mind, but your literally your time.
Yeah, well, I mean, even to go back to a game I talked about in New Business, but Modern Warfare 2 and its predecessor, I think that game is pushing interactive storytelling and the kind of storytelling that really you can only do in a video game. I think it's pushing it as much as any series out there. Mm-hmm. And yet, it sold, 8 million copies last year? I mean, they have couched some pretty radical ideas about what you can do with a video game into a package that everybody wants to play, and most people did.
I think when you've got something as multifaceted as games, it's easy to draw some of these kind of dichotomies between, you know, different kinds of games have different kinds of aims, different objectives in terms of how they want to affect you or what they're trying to do. But it's not as if these sorts of things don't occur in other media. Films, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's plenty of films that people would think are not primarily aimed at affecting you on an emotional level, that are questionable in their artistic merit, but, you know, they're kind of fun to look at, like as a ride or whatever. I mean, and then you've got the art house stuff on the other side. I mean, it really isn't so different. It's just more tangibly different in the case of the game because, you know, it's different in the way that, you know, the very gameplay of the game is.
It is actually a tangible experience.
Well, James must be thoroughly disgusted by this whole topic.
Well, see, the problem is I can't let this show go out making it seem like I consent to this position. Basically, very few films are art, very few paintings are art, very few musical performances are art, and similarly, very few games are art.
Okay, so we've got a semantics argument.
No, this isn't a semantics. This is fundamentally what art is.
We're arguing about the meaning of art.
It's a definition problem. You can't call something, well, I guess you could say that, but
that's what semantics is.
It's going beyond just what the definition of art is. It's what art means, and not the literal meaning, but what it means as a society, what its purpose is. And I would argue that almost no horror movies are art because they don't particularly do anything that would define them as such.
You don't think Scary Movie 4 is germane to our culture?
I don't think it's art.
I mean,
art.
I think it is. It may be absolutely.
You can be culturally relevant
movie,
and not
but
be
it,
art.
It means something about us, and it means something about the people who made it and what they think about the people who they made it for.
The news is culturally germane, but it's not art.
Well, the news is not a creative endeavor, James.
Yeah, I suppose the argument would be that Scary Movie 4 isn't a creative.
I would argue it's not much of one. No. No, but to be art, you have to have an emotion that you're trying to get into everyone who would interact with this piece of. You're creating a connection between not just the artist and the viewer, but between the viewer and every other person who views it now and in perpetuity.
Okay.
The idea is that there is an emotional message you are trying to get across here, and it can't just be, this is funny, laugh. It has to be, this makes you feel something. Mm-hmm. That is what art's supposed to do. So most movies are bad. They don't do that, and that's why they're not art. Most paintings, like reproductions, they don't do that because the artist isn't the one depicting an emotion. The person that he's copying did. So all those paintings of landscapes that are basically just generic landscapes, they aren't art because the artist didn't have any sort of emotion that he was tying into this. He was just trying to score some money. It has artistic elements, but that doesn't define something as being art.
But what if it generates an emotion in the person who consumes it?
But it's the idea is that it's the connection between the artist and all those who consume it. They get the artist's emotion that they were trying to put into it.
Well, James, you're making very much the same argument that Roger Ebert is, in that games can't be art because the creator doesn't know exactly what's going to happen when a person plays it.
See, that's why I don't agree with that.
That's his definition of art, is that it is a transference of knowledge or emotion from the creator to the consumer. And if you can't establish a firm relationship there, then it's no longer really art. No matter
how good it is. See, I disagree though, because the game developers can determine what the confines of what is going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, they set the parameters. There's only so many things you can do within the confines of a game. They can still channel you to emotional experiences that get across the emotion they're trying to transmit to you.
Mm-hmm.
They still have the ultimate control. So, games can be art, and there are games that have been art, but the overwhelming... I mean, Pac-Man's not art. In no way, shape, or form is that art. Similarly, in no way... shape or form are the majority of like romantic comedies art, because they're just repetition of the same common themes we have. The creator isn't trying to get across their emotional feelings. They're just trying to make some money. That's why it's hard to say that can games be art? Well, yes, but are all games art? Definitely not.
So for you, it's not, there's a qualitative element, but it's not that good games are art and bad games aren't.
No. Well, the creator has to have the intention of trying to get something across. Uh-huh. There has to be an active effort.
But you're getting into a territory where you're going to try and legislate intent. I mean, you're going to say, is the game bad because, or the film or whatever it would be bad as a work of art or in general because they were creatively bankrupt, or did they intend to make something that was emotionally impactful but just singularly failed?
I'd like to know how can you even know what the creator was
In some cases, that might be transparent. In other cases, it might not. And when you're talking about intensely collaborative projects like video games, were some of the people really putting their earnest effort to make it emotional, and then some of them were collecting a check? I mean,
If
60% of the workforce is trying to make it artistic, or is the threshold, 80?
To who did the design. I mean, at some point, there is a person whose vision we're trying to manifest here.
I would question how much that's necessarily the case in every game. I mean, they are so collaborative. It's all tour stuff. I don't know how much you want to bring it into game. But here's the thing. Say, for instance, you got someone who's the visionary of the game, and he has the best artistic intentions, but his subordinates are entirely inept and can't deliver on it.
Then he's not doing a good job managing his subordinates.
How would you discern between the failure of his vision and the failure of their capacity?
The
difference between art and not art is intent. But if you can't perceive the intent, then how does one know that it's not art or it isn't?
I can perceive that there isn't anything that indicates there was intent or that it failed to deliver the message that was there.
I guess my problem with the way that you're approaching this, James, and I'm sure there are a lot of people who agree with you, and my problem with this approach to the question of games or anything else as art is that the definition becomes so nuanced and so complex that you can't create any kind of even remotely consistent formula for how to determine whether any particular thing is art or isn't.
It basically becomes completely ad hoc, and it's just like practically a smell test. It's just like, well, does it smell like art? Well, it goes to me.
It's closer to does it feel like art? And the answer is, if it does.
But different things will feel differently to everybody.
I can't tell you what's pornographic, but I know it when I see it. I mean, it's a specious way to look at things. Like, I just don't see how that, what benefit is there to arguing about this?
Well, because that's what the question is. The question is it art? Well, you have to have a defined starting point to make that discussion.
But the point is, the original question, if you want to bring it back to that, was about games in general can be considered art. Now, so this question of whether a lot of games aren't or whatever is irrelevant, because it's about the media.
There are games that could be considered art.
So is therefore the whole medium a legitimate art form, even if many of his examples don't really
aspire to that? It is an art form with many members of it that are not art.
Okay. Well, that's where James stands. So anyway, I'm going to have to cut it off there. We could probably go a lot longer. And, you know, I'm willing to do that if people want to. So if the whole games as art discussion has you riled up, if you have a strong opinion on it, send us an email, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Let us know. But for now, we're going to have to close down the show. Thanks for listening. I hope you made it through. And just want to remind everybody that the retroactive poll is ongoing. You can vote on that. By the time the show goes up, you'll still have a few days left to get your vote in. And yeah, once again, look into the whole PAX East thing. Let us know if you're going to be there. And let us know what you'd like to see or what you'd like to hear. And with that, I think we're going to have to cut it off this week. So thank you for listening once again. I've been Jonathan and Greg, James, John. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
So, in the continuing adventures of me not having an Xbox, which is
God,
horrible,
man.
And this is how sad it's gotten. So I called them Friday night. So I actually got transferred to their repair center in Texas. Now, granted, I called at like 11:30 at night, coming in after going to the bar because I was pissed. So like, let's go for it.
You were pissed in more sense
than
one.
That liquor courage to call Microsoft.
Well, that was my fourth call, so technically that doesn't count as liquor courage.